coalition forces and begin striking selected targets of military importance.
It would be a decision which could only be taken once.
There's no argument over the choice between peace and war.
Unconfirmed reports about Gaddafi being captured.
This morning, I want to talk about the future of Europe.
Burning Point.
Hello and welcome to the show. With me, Ekaterina Kudashkina. Turkey is likely to join the anti-ISIS coalition led by the United States. Earlier this week, the country's government filed a proposal to the parliament saying, and I quote, to ask permission from parliament to send the Turkish armed forces, if necessary, to foreign countries for cross-border operations and interventions, and to position foreign militaries in Turkey for the same purposes, end quote. The move is largely a formality. Our guest speaker, Ekrem Edi Güzeldere, journalist and political analyst based in Istanbul, says.
That is more or less a formality because the governing party has an absolute majority and it's a rather homogeneous group within the parliament. The more delicate question, therefore, is how Turkey will participate in the war against IS. Is it only, for example, allowing the U.S. military and other NATO members to use the military infrastructure within Turkey, to use the air bases for flights over Syria? Or is it more active participation of the Turkish military on Syrian territory? There has, until recently, been the situation that there were Turkish hostages in the hands of IS, and therefore Turkey said they cannot risk the life of these 46 Turkish citizens. These are liberated now, but that does not mean that IS does not pose a constant threat also to Turkey. There are estimated sleeping cells of IS sympathizers and non-active combatants within Turkey. There are IS potential combatants who travel through Turkey to Syria and who are several days or weeks within Turkey. So there's always the risk of terrorist attacks or of taking other hostages within Turkey or, for example, also outside Turkey. There is the mausoleum of the grandfather of the first Sultan of the Ottoman Empire that is very close to Kobane, where the current clashes between IS and Kurdish fighters occur, and there are only 35 Turkish soldiers that could easily be taken hostage again by IS. So there is a constant danger of terrorism and threatening Turkey by IS, even if there are no hostages in their hands.
And as far as I understand, the hostage crisis has also given rise to a lot of discussions as to how and why the IS has liberated the hostages.
Sure, and even President Erdogan confirmed that there were negotiations between Turkish state and some state institutions, maybe also with foreign help, and IS. Then there is a lot of speculation what was part of that deal. Some say that arms were delivered to IS from Turkey in response to liberating the hostages. Others said there's logistic help, but there might also be a deal on how Turkey should act in the near future and not be militarily participating in the coalition. I mean, this permission is already existing and for many years, and it's not specifically concerning one country, one region, or one group. So this is for activities of the Turkish military outside of Turkey, and it's very general terminology that is used for this permission. This could include several things. One is to allow foreign militaries to use Turkey and its infrastructure. And the other is to be active with its own military abroad, but I don't expect this in the near future that Turkey will posit soldiers on Syrian territory, but it could help the coalition logistically and with its infrastructure, or it could also use its air force in addition to the other armies to also fly over Syria.
Dr. Güzeldere, what is your forecast? How do you see the whole situation with the IS developing?
I'm pretty sure that this permission will be given in parliament, but there are question marks on what that means in the near future. if the Kurds are not helped in and around Kobane. This is a question of time when IS will take this strategically very important city that would link an area to IS to control hundreds of kilometers on Syrian soil. For the Kurds, it's also symbolically very important to hold this this canton, which is one of three in Syria. So if the Kurds are not helped militarily by weapons or by fighting actively against IS, be it by Turkey or by any other of the coalition, then it's a question of time when they will be overrun by IS, who is militarily a lot stronger and has the better weapons. So if the international coalition wants to prevent that, then they need to actively help the Kurds in and around Kobane.
Sir, thank you so much. And just to remind you, our guest speaker was Ekrem Edik Güzeldere, Turkish journalist and political analyst based in Istanbul. This is Burning Point, taking a closer look at Turkey's special role in the anti-ISIS military campaign. There is another detail which might make things even more complicated. And this is something we're proceeding to discuss with our guest speaker, Gareth Jenkins, a senior associate fellow with Silk Road Studies Program and Turkey Initiative. So it looks like Turkey is still hesitant whether it should join it or not. Why?
I think because its priorities are different to most of the rest of the world. Of course, what the US-led coalition is trying to do at the moment with its airstrikes is to degrade the Islamic State's military capabilities and to halt its advances in Syria and Iraq. Turkey, and particularly President Erdogan, has always been a lot more concerned about the Assad regime. And their priority is getting rid of Assad. It doesn't mean that they like the Islamic State, but that is their priority. So what Turkey's been talking about in military action, I think, is different to the military action that's taking place. What Turkey really wants is a buffer zone in Syria and military action to create and support that buffer zone, including a no-fly zone. And, of course, that can only really be against Assad because the Islamic State doesn't have any aircraft. There's no point in having a no-fly zone against them. But I think that's where the confusion is coming from. To a large extent, I think Turkey and the rest of the world are looking at fighting two different wars. Erdogan is still very keen on getting rid of Assad. He sees Assad's retention of power as a humiliation because he's so often called Assad to be overthrown. Whereas, of course, most of the international community is now more concerned about the Islamic State than it is about Assad. Even the ones who are opposed to Assad.
I've read quite a number of stories with certain speculations about the nature of relationship between Turkey and the IS.
Yes, it's very complex, in fact. I mean, when you go back over the last couple of years, there have been some contacts between Turkey and the extremist groups in Syria in particular, mainly with al-Nusra rather than the Islamic State. And, of course, Islamic State and al-Nusra split up. In the last few days, al-Nusra has said it's going to support the Islamic State against the U.S.-led airstrikes. But Turkey's contacts really were with al-Nusra rather than the Islamic State, and they weren't so much active support, but more tolerance of al-Nusra and other extremist groups using Turkey as a platform for their campaign to overthrow Assad. There was some more restrictions introduced since early 2013, and then some of the kind of bases, not in terms of military bases, but in terms of kind of a propaganda organization. These organizations had places in Turkey which they were using, particularly for forwarding foreign militants who, you know, came to Turkey and then crossed the border to fight against Assad. The restrictions were imposed forced those organizations to do more of that kind of thing across the border, actually inside Syria. But I was in the border area a few weeks ago, and the restrictions still weren't very tight. On the official border crossings, even though there were people checking documents, etc. But when you went up into the mountains, and the west of the Turkish-Syrian border actually runs through mountains which have these old smuggling routes and are relatively porous, unlike the east where it's mostly flat terrain. But you went up into the mountains, in some of the villages there were, you know, foreign jihadists just sitting around in the village waiting to be smuggled across. So even though Turkey has distance itself to a certain extent from the jihadists, it probably still hasn't done enough to satisfy the rest of the world in terms of clamping down. And also extraordinary, really, in Turkey that we have tens of thousands of websites which are blocked. Turkish language websites supporting both al-Nusra and really extremist ones are supporting the Islamic State are still able to operate with impunity. So no attempt has been made to close those down. So you have this kind of very confused and mixed policy by Turkey, whereas, yes, it has made some movement, it has imposed some restrictions, but they still fall a long way short of, I think, what most of the rest of the world would like to see.
Our guest speaker is Gareth Jenkins, Senior Associate Fellow with Silk Road Studies Program and Turkey Initiative.
Burning Point.
And how about those hostages? What is the story? What is the real story?
We don't know, is the honest answer. I mean, for a long time, they were held for over 3 months. There were negotiations right from the very beginning between Turkey and the Islamic State. At the same time as those Turkish hostages were released, and they were released, it wasn't a rescue operation, or it wasn't Turkey's intelligence organization somehow getting them out of Iraq. They were released by the Islamic State. At the same time, some Islamic State prisoners were being held by a Sunni organization, which has very good relations with Turkey. Those Islamic State prisoners were handed over to the Islamic State. So it does look in that a prisoner exchange was part of a deal, but it seems almost certain that there was a package and that prisoner exchange was part of the package. The rest of the package, we don't know. Turkey has very strongly denied that it paid a ransom, and it's probably telling the truth because the Islamic State has so much money, particularly now from illegal oil exports, that it doesn't really need the money. But what else was given in terms of whether anything kind of material given or whether some other commitments were given remains unclear. But it's a very ambivalent relationship anyway. I mean, the Islamic State publicly, it says that, you know, the Justice and Development Party government in Turkey is an apostate regime, which means that it's a legitimate target for attacks. And yet at the same time, both sides have been reluctant to antagonize the other. There is a lot of concern in Turkey, and I think it's soundly based, I think it's their right to be concerned, about possible attacks inside Turkey by Islamic State sympathizers if Turkey takes a very strong stance against the Islamic State. And at the same time, the Islamic State doesn't want to antagonize Turkey too much because even though it now faces some restrictions in Turkey, they're not really very stringent. So it doesn't want those restrictions to be increased and for the border to be completely sealed or for its propaganda and recruiting efforts in Turkey to be completely closed down. So there is this ambivalent relation between the two. I mean, it's not as clear-cut as there being an alliance. It's not that. But both have reasons for not wanting to antagonize the other too much. We had in May 2011 an attack which everybody assumes, although the Turkish state still denies it, still blames it on Assad. We had an attack in Reyhanlı on the Syrian border where 53 people were killed. And since then, there have been numerous intelligence reports of possible attacks by Islamic State sympathizers inside Turkey. So I think the threat is real. And I think that, Turkey is right to be concerned about it. But the other question, of course, is how Turkey's past policy actually helped make the Islamic State and the other Islamist extremists as strong as they are today. So to a certain extent, the threat, the genuine threat that Turkey faces now is a result of its past policy.
Sir, thank you so much. And just to remind you, this time our guest speaker was Gareth Jenkins, Senior Associate Fellow with Silk Road Studies Program and Turkey Initiative. Well, and with this, we end this edition of Burning Point, brought to you by me, Ekaterina Kudashkina. Thank you so much for staying with us. Goodbye, and take care.